Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and today we have a roundtable discussion about Wisconsin wildlife and nature today. Always great to welcome back our three guests who come by every 2-3 months or so to talk with us. Dean Bortz, the editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. Dean, are you there?
I am, Larry. Hello.
Hi. Great to have you with us. I'll be up your way in a few days. Actually, June 6th, I'll be in Minocqua to give a talk. So
that's right. You're going to be there for Science on Tap at the brewery.
Yeah, Science on Tap at the brewery. So I'm looking forward to that. Anyway, hope to see you there. Pat Durkin, a freelance writer, editor, and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Larry.
Love to have you by. And Tim Isley with me in the studio. The other two guys are with us by phone. Tim is a full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. He brought along some just beautiful outdoor photos we're taking a look at, and I think we may have a couple up on our Ideas Network Facebook page for you to see as well. Anyway, Tim, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry. Thanks for having us.
Well, it's always fun to have these guys talk about what's going on in wildlife, and certainly we can talk about the whole range of events that have taken place that may affect wildlife and what's going on in terms of fishing, hunting, and so forth, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call with your own questions, comments, or maybe experience to share, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post your photo or your question on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Dean, fishing season underway in Wisconsin. The opener up there, was there still ice or was it open?
Oh, there was still ice on a lot of the bigger lakes. Some of the smaller, the medium-sized lakes were more or less open, or at least open enough to get a boat in and then fish around the edges of the ice. The rivers were open. Parts of the flowages, like the Rainbow and the Willow, Turtle Flambeau, were open. And so people were able to get in and do some fishing, and they actually did pretty well.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, oh, sure, because of the, you know, had everything been iced over, it would have been a little tough. But because things were opening up, the water temperatures are just where they needed to be for walleyes to be in shallow water, northerns to still be there, perch to still be there, bluegills hanging around the little bit on the they call it the staging areas, getting ready to come in. So, yeah, they were catching fish at a pretty good clip in most places.
I know there's the free fishing weekend is coming up. Isn't it this Saturday and Sunday? I think it is.
Yeah. 2nd and 3rd of June, yes.
Talk about that for a minute. I think that's a wonderful way to get some people introduced to fishing.
It sure is. If you haven't fished or don't fish often and don't have a license, it's at this time of the year, June 2nd, 3rd, you can fish for free. You still have to follow all the guidelines, fishing regulations, size limits, bag limits, and stuff, but you don't need a fishing license, and you don't have to have trout stamps in order to participate. And I don't know, maybe one of the other fellows know how long this has been going on, but we've had free fishing weekend for quite a while now, and we also have a winter one now, too, for ice fishing.
Yeah, that's great. Really, Pat, do you remember when that started?
I do not.
Yeah, and Tim, I see, I'm looking at Tim, and I can see he's thinking the wheels are turning there.
They turn slowly, Larry. I think it's about at least 10, 12 years we've had that annually, and it's really a good way for people to get out, and especially if they don't have a license, if they want to get out and just try it, this is a good opportunity for them to do that, and especially some of the fishing clubs, like here in Madison, the O'Hara Fishing Club, and groups like that. It's good that, you know, you make contact with some of them, and they might take people out and take people fishing and show them how to do it.
You know, there are some anglers who are looking for record-setting catches. You know, they're that 85-pound muskie that's in Trout Lake. I would like to have that one. what's the process? Dean, you know the process for recording those? I tell you, I had a situation many years ago where I caught a 20-pound northern on Lake Mendota with 4-pound test line. And on an 8th-ounce Panther Martin.
Yeah, temporarily had a line class record there.
Well, I probably did, but at the time I didn't, you know, I didn't know what to, I didn't know, well, I probably should have looked into it, but instead I just took some pictures and actually weighed it and put it back in the water. But what is the process for recording them?
Well, I think we have two options, if I remember this correctly. The one that I know best of is the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame in Hayward, where Emmett Brown is the executive director, and you know, they have a protocol that a person can go through to apply or at least send in their information for a possible record. And they have a number of categories. You know, you have the all-time, all-weight, you know, the biggest, heaviest fish of any type. But then they also have catch and release records, which are by length. And then they have line class records. So if you catch a fish on, you know, a line that tests out at 4-pound test, 6-pound test, they have it, you know, probably from 2-pound test all the way up to maybe 50-pound test or unlimited. And then they, you know, so you can have, you know, heaviest fish of different types at all those different weight or line classes. And then you can also have, let's see, they have winter ones. They have a pole line with no reel. In fact, a friend of mine, Ken Jackson, I don't know if he still holds it, but Kenny saw an opening for a possible world record with a pole line, no reel. So he took a maple stick and tied some line to it, put a sucker on it, and caught a, I think it was a 42 or 44-inch muskie, and then released it. So he had that record just by, you know, doing something that nobody else thought of. This was kind of fun for him.
Normally, Dean, I think, wouldn't they have to take it into a place that has a certified meat scale and have it weighed? Am I correct on that? To have it and have it witnessed and weighed?
If it's a kept fish, yeah. And then I forgot to mention, I said two ways. The other way is, you know, the DNR also is now tracking fish records. So they can go to the DNR website. People can go on there and research what they need to do to apply for a record through the Department of Natural Resources.
Well, to give you an idea of my age, I'm a charter member of the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, and if you climb up that giant muskie in Hayward, my name is emblazoned right up on the left side of that fish's mouth.
I'm going to have to go up there and look for that this summer, Larry.
I tell you what, it's always a fun place to visit, actually. DNR is looking to reduce the, you mentioned walleye, the five walleye bag limit on the Winnebago system. You know, Dean, Pat, too, what are your thoughts on that?
Pat, you want to go first?
Sure. I know I wrote about that about a month or two ago, and there's, overall, at that time, there was pretty good support for it. You know, the DNR was going around to different sportsmen's clubs, and they basically have advisory-type groups in this area to talk about it. And, of course, then after I wrote about it, I started hearing from people who weren't so fond of the idea, which is always part of our process, too. But overall, you know, by comparing the return rates on tag walleyes they get, you know, in the caught at tournaments and whatever, the DNR was starting to get a little concerned that maybe there is a higher take of walleyes than what they had realized. And so they've been talking about possibly reducing it. But, you know, we're not, I don't think they're ready to do it anytime soon, probably, you know, probably at least in our year or so of discussions. But, yeah, it's, I guess my sense is that most guys will go along with it. They tend to like the fact that DNR in this area has been pretty proactive on the Winnebago system and keeping the public involved in the decision-making process. So I guess I wouldn't be surprised if they did lower it at some point to 3.
Yeah, I wouldn't. And Dean, you wouldn't either?
No, I wouldn't be surprised if that happens, but I think, like Pat said, it's going to take a little bit of discussion to get from here to there, because when Pat said that there's some folks who are opposed to it, and it isn't just, you know, the average folks. There's a, you know, well, Walleyes for Tomorrow. I mean, everybody knows about Walleyes for Tomorrow in Wisconsin. That group does a lot of good work for, you know, the resources in the state. And there's a few members of the group, the leader, Mike Arrowwood, who's been, you know, he just works hand in hand with the DNR on so many different projects. You know, Mike has had some reservations about it. He hasn't been overly outspoken about it. He just, I think he kind of would like to talk quietly with the DNR about some of his concerns before, you know, going too far down that road. But, Yeah, he has some numbers, too, that he's been looking at. He has shared them, you know, with me, and we haven't really taken them anywhere yet. I want to get a little bit more background with where Mike's thinking about things. But I also had a chance to talk to Kendall Comke, who's, you know, heading up the whole Winnebago system management right now. And, you know, and he has his views, too. And it sounds like there's a shortage of forage, and because of that, people are having an awful lot of success catching a lot of walleyes right now. And not when I say right now, I mean it's been for some time. So there's a little bit of concern there about over-exploitation for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's take a call. By the way, you can join in, too, 800-642-1234 with your own questions. We're right now talking fishing. We can take other, certainly other wildlife questions as well. But Jeff has something relating to fishing. So let's go to Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, you talked about people's experience fishing. I was out a week and a half ago at Baroqua, where the DNR puts on a learn-to-fishing program, fish-for-dinner program. It is geared at generally younger adults or people who just haven't had much opportunity to fish because their parents moved around a lot or were... or urbanizing and not giving kids an opportunity to learn. Anyway, the program teaches people about aquatic biology, stream habitat, all kinds of things, in this case, geared toward trout. They also have programs geared toward lake fishing as well for panfish and game fish. So it's a good opportunity for people to get involved with fishing if they want to and haven't had the opportunity in the past. There's all kinds of information on the DNR website if they want to. Take advantage of that.
Excellent. Thanks very much for calling. Tim, a comment on that?
Yeah, it sounds very good. But the Learn to Fish and Learn to Hunt for Food, these are two really good programs that give people an opportunity to try it for the first time and just learn about being outdoors, but also learn about the way to get their own food and get wild meat and learn more about the resource. I think it sounds like two really good programs.
Yeah, thanks again for that call. Let's go to Mike in Allenton next. Mike, hi, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Along the lines on the Lake Winnebago walleye fishing, I'm curious as to why the DNR has not proposed or even seemed to be looking into a slot size. Most other bodies of water for walleyes like the Pete and Well, Castle Rock, they do have a slot size. And then I don't understand why they don't want to do that on Winnebago, and because obviously you're protecting your spawning females. And the other thing along with that is that by having a slot size, you're limiting the number of small or the big fish that the reproducers that you want to keep.
Let's see. Dean, do you want to take a crack at that?
Well, I can try. Yeah, I live up here in Vilas, right on, almost on the border of Vilas, Oneida County. So we have a lot of lakes right around where I live, and some of them have the slot size limits, and some of them don't. So we have a little bit of everything going on up here. And in talking to the local fish biologist from the DNR, a lot of it depends upon the type of water that you're dealing with. That you're looking at. So, they look at walleye density, walleye growth rates, reproduction rates, and maybe a few other factors, but at least those three for sure, in deciding what types of regulations they should put where. Now, maybe, you know, in the past, the Winnebago system has been had a very robust natural walleye reproduction going on in there. Maybe that's why they don't feel they need a slot limit. And maybe the Winnebago system has very good growth rates, so maybe the fish grow quickly enough to where they feel they don't need a slot limit. But that's my understanding of it.
Yeah. Pat, anything in your writing on...
Yeah. The Winnebago system is just a fascinating operation as far as walleye production. You know, they spawn along the Wolf River and the Fox River, and the DNR has worked with sportsmen's clubs really pretty extensively in the last 30 years to clear out a lot of these old marshes and stuff where they're overgrown or had been kind of co-opted into basically private land practices and got overgrown in a lot of spots. So they really have been doing a great job working with people and getting those walleye marshes more productive. And so over the years, you look at the walleye reproduction in the Winnebago system, and it has normal ebbs and flows you expect with any kind of natural system, but
this, but never any indication that the system is being overworked as far as walleye production. There, we have really good growth rates. Back in the 80s, you know, you started seeing the gizzard shad, a southern fish, showing up in the system, and at first there was a lot of concern about what the gizzard shad would do to the Winnebago system. Well, it turns out that they actually provided this great forage base that made the walleye grow faster than ever. So I just never have heard a whole lot of push for slot limits. It's one of those, you know, flavor of the day type things sometimes. People go fishing somewhere else and like a slot limit or whatever it might be, and they decide, well, we should do that here. And unless you can actually show a need for it in that specific water body, because every water body is different, you know, as far as its production rates and that, those kind of the natural factors. So I guess I have not heard a whole lot about a big push for it or a need for it.
Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Dean Boritz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer, here on the Ideas Network. Talking wildlife with our three guests today, Dean Boritz, Pat Durkin, and Tim Isley. I'm Larry Mueller. If you have a wildlife question or maybe an experience to share, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Paul and Wausau online, John in Green Bay. But before we get to them, Pat, you wanted to mention that it's orphaned wildlife season, quotes, and you had an encounter yourself recently that pretty interesting.
Yeah, I got thinking about this firsthand yesterday morning. I was out for I'm a runner, so I was out running at about 5 o'clock yesterday morning. By the time I got past our local middle school area and grade school area, it's called the Wapaka Learning Center. I looked ahead and I saw this doe, and she's crossing one of the driveways going through the learning center area. And then I know she's kind of by the time I saw her, I could see some motion down below, you know, by her feet, her hoofs. And I looked and I thought, God, I wonder if she just dropped a fawn, because this fawn was there. But then when I got up closer to them, I realized, no, the fawn's it's not just born. It's fairly young, though, because it was in the short time I saw it, you could tell it really had wobbly legs. But anyway, by the time I got up there, it was flat out hiding, you know, trying its best to hide atop this blacktop. So it's kind of funny in a way. You thought that poor thing doesn't even realize that there's nothing here to hide it. But the doe was about maybe 20 yards away, just hovering around, watching me, and I quick got a couple of pictures, and then she moved off. But then I kept running, and I looked back, and I saw who I presume was a teacher, must have seen me out there, you know, wondering what was going on. And he walked over, and he was trying to determine what to do. He was calling someone, talking to someone, and I just kind of interrupted him. I said, I think the sooner we get out of here, the better, you know, that the doe is right over there waiting to come back and keep that fawn moving along. So that was my encounter, and, you know, it happens basically every year that week before Memorial Day weekend, typically in the week after the first part of June. The whitetails are swamping the woods with their newborns, and every year people think they're finding these orphan fawns when it's actually just that doe is nearby monitoring the situation, probably. At least her ears are on full alert. And so typically if you just leave the fawns alone, you know, in most cases the doe will be nearby and come along soon enough to take care of it.
It's interesting that about 2 week period, we go from the lowest number of deer in the state to the highest number in about a 2 week time period.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's nature at work.
Nature at work for sure. And before we go back to the phones, I wanted to ask you, Tim, about some Natural Resources Foundation field trips. There's some that are coming up where there's some openings here.
Exactly, Larry. I think it's a good segue here, because Pat's talking about hands off of wildlife, and now we're going to talk about hands on wildlife.
Yeah.
But the Natural Resource Foundation is a nonprofit organization that puts on field trips. They've done this for 25 years, and they've got field trips throughout the state of Wisconsin. And it's such a good way to get out and see different areas of the state, and they're led by people who really are biologists or retired biologists, naturalists who know about the outdoors. And it's so fun to get out and learn about these things. And this year they've got over 210 field trips throughout the state. And I checked just the other day because people register for those in March. And there's people at the deadline who are right on their computers when the registration opens up. They're on their computers registering for these. So some of the field trips have filled up. But some of the field trips that are already unfilled, where there still are some openings, one is Trumpeter Swans up at Crex Meadows up in Burnett County. That's in the middle of July. Another one, Dragonflies and Damselflies down in Milwaukee, July 19th. Banning Birds of the Northwoods in Washburn County on August the 25th. And another one, Saw-Whet Owl Banding in Stevens Point. And there are several dates in mid-October. And the Saw-Whet Owl, when you see these things, they're little nature's little quarter pounder. They are so cute, these little owls. And they call them in, and then they come into some netting, and then people can actually hold them and band them. So there's really so many good opportunities to get out and learn about different things maybe that we didn't know about. But I'd encourage people to look up the Natural Resources Foundation, go onto their website, look for the field trips, and there are some of these that are still open. Monarch tagging up at Horicon Marsh is another one. These are really good opportunities to get out and learn.
Yeah, I certainly agree, and they're lot of fun. I've been on many, and I know they're fun. We should take a call here from Paul in Wausau, who's been waiting a bit. Then we'll get to John. But, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hello. Hey, thank you. Yeah, I do a little fishing. I'm not much of a fisherman, but I catch some bass occasionally. And when I get them, I find plastic worms inside of them. And I guess I'm wondering about them. If they just stay in the fish, it seems like they don't decompose. I did a little research, and it seems like in some of the big bass lakes in the south, the bottoms are literally covered with these plastic crawlers and stuff that they're just thrown over the end of the boat. And you got any comment on that, or
I don't
know about that.
Thanks a lot for calling, Paul. And I'm not sure, Dean or Pat or Tim, any comments on that?
No, that there has been some discussion about the, I guess if you want to call it a residue or maybe it's litter, I don't know. But you know, you're using plastic tackle or baits. And they do get ripped off the hooks eventually or over time, and or a fish will actually swallow them. The caller's question as far as what happens to them once they're in the fish, you know, I really don't know. I'm sure they don't disintegrate. They don't get digested. So how long do they stay in the fish? Does the fish expel them? I don't know. But I do know that in some of the bass lakes, the popular bass lakes around here where I fish, you'll see different colored tails and grubs on the bottom where they've fallen off a hook. So, do we do about it? I don't know that anybody's ever addressed that.
I think a couple of years ago, there was a manufacturer who started manufacturing some that would decompose, supposedly, but I don't know the current status of that.
I'll have to look into that a bit too and see if talk to Scott Craven or some of these other folks and see what if they know about any of the research. It's an interesting question for sure. And one that hasn't been that's the first time that's been addressed on the show since I've been doing it.
This is how we get our great story ideas.
Pat.
Really, I always encourage people to send me a note if they have a question, because really there's so many ideas out there that we just, for whatever reason, haven't tackled, and that's one that I've never tackled. I thought as soon as Paul started talking, I thought, oh, how could we have never covered that topic before? But it's got me thinking.
Well, good. So the next time you're on, I hope to have a full report, Pat.
Okay.
Let's go to John in Green Bay next. John, thanks for waiting.
Hi, guys. Great show. So a question and a comment. And the first one has to do with muskie regulations. When they make special regulations for lakes, I'll give an example. I know an area both Pat and I know you, Larry, are familiar with. Up in Clam Lake area, there's a lake up there, Day Lake, that it's a very good muskie lake, but they made a 28-inch size limit. And I have a question, I guess, I guide for more wilderness lakes for muskies up there, and The question I have is, when they make a size limit like that at 28 inches, are they encouraging people to keep a muskie? Are they thinking that the population's a little bit out of whack and they want you to actually keep one? Or are they just saying that that's kind of the size limit that that lake can sustain if people keep them? Because I've had a couple discussions with people on that, and I don't really know. I mean, I if they want us to keep one, we'll keep one, but typically we release everything.
Yeah, that's what I do as well. Tim, you were going to say something on this?
Well, usually the minimum size limit is basically to protect some of the spawning fish. So it just means that basically you can keep something over that size limit. I don't think they're encouraging you to keep the fish. I mean, if you want to keep the fish, if it's over that, fine. But at least the main thing is to protect that size limit. Earlier, like when we were talking about walleyes, on opening day, I was opening up on the Chetek chain of lakes, and they had the official opener up there, and their size limit on walleyes, they had a minimum of 15, then it went up to 19, and then there was a slot size from 19 to 24, but then one over 24. So they were protecting those fish in that slot size. So each time they put those minimums on, you don't want to take the fish that are less than that to protect the spawners.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's my understanding, Larry, that I know on daylight, because I haven't fished daylight myself, but I know I always keep intending to fish it because I know you can keep muskies, you know, above 28 inches there. And my understanding was that they actually are encouraging to get some of the muskies out of there because there are so many of them in lakes like that. There's a number of them. I think Spillerberg Lake, too, over in the same county has a 28-inch size limit. I'm sorry?
Dean, you were going to say what?
Mineral Lake is also. Pat's right. There's about 12 or 14 lakes in the state that have a 28-inch size limit, and it's for that reason, like Pat said, that they have slow growth rates and above average natural reproduction for muskies, so they have more muskies in there than the forage can support, so they are encouraging people to pull some fish out of there to give the other ones room to grow.
Yeah, that actually makes sense to me. It's always hard, though, to keep one. You know,
the ethics or the mentality has been beaten into us with a broken oar.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, release. And in some places, it doesn't hurt to keep a few.
Yeah.
I know my friend Heberlein, he's got that shack in Ashland County, not too far from Deer Lake. And I know one of our little things we do is it's basically the eating of the sacred muskie. Every now and then, Heberlein or his friends will catch a muskie that from one of those slow-growing lakes, and then fillet it, and we'll eat it, and then always try to feel guilty about it. But I don't feel guilty because I figure, you know, there's a regulation there for a reason. I support scientific wildlife, fish and wildlife management, so I eat muskie without guilt.
I tell you, they are. I haven't eaten one in quite a few years, but they are really good. They're really good. Poach them in some crab oil and put a little melted butter with them. And ooh. John, thanks a lot for that question. Appreciate it very much. Dennis in Green Bay has something for us. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I wanted to call and thank Mr. Durkin. His writings years ago about the Conservation Congress and Mr. Murphy got me to get off my butt and get involved, and it was one of the best things I've ever done, being involved and being on some of the committees. And I know things have changed now. I've been involved for about 10 years, but it's a worthwhile process if you're thinking about it, because you're not there to change laws or conservation practices for yourself. You're doing it for your kids and your grandkids. So it's just a great, great organization. And thank you, Mr. Durkin, for getting me involved.
Pat, comment. That's nice.
That made my day. That doesn't happen very often. I really appreciate that. I agree. I when people complain about our government, our system of our checks and balances, all these things that make up our democracy, I think the Conservation Congress is a good example of that. Wisconsin, I've criticized the Congress a lot over the years for various things, but the thing I've never called for, and I hope people will realize this, I've never called for getting rid of it. Because like it or not, all these things that sometimes irritate us about our democracy, well, they do balance out over time, and keeps people involved. And if you don't get involved, you really can't complain about what happens. So the more people get involved in these things, I think the better off we'll all be. So I really appreciate when guys like John call in and tell me that something I wrote inspired them to get involved like that, because that's just so important if you want to have, you know, good, responsible, representative government.
Yeah. And Dennis, thank you so much for that call. And just along that line, Pat, maybe Dean and Tim want to chime in too. The Wisconsin Conservation Congress has decided to allow online voting next year. Wonder what you guys think about that. Wow. Tim, start with you. Oh, that's the first you're hearing it?
No, it's not. It's just been talked about for quite a while. And it, to me, and this is Dean talking here, to me it's a little scary, depending upon how it's structured. Because I've heard scenarios where we could have people from, believe it or not, Russia, voting online on Wisconsin issues. Who's ever heard of that before?
Yeah.
It's a natural.
Seriously, you know, I'm not sure how you can structure it, or maybe you don't need to structure it, to allow just the people from Wisconsin to vote on it. Do you have to have a customer ID number from the DNR to punch in? I'm not sure how this is going to work. I tried getting a hold of Larry Bondi last night, the chairman of the Conservation Congress, and I talked to Mark Schultz about a month ago. He's the chairman of the committee for this project. At that time, they didn't have a scenario under which they were going to work yet, but apparently now they do. What the parameters are.
Tim Isley?
At the Natural Resources Board meeting last Wednesday, Larry Bondi spoke before the board and said this is one of his most proudest moments for what the Conservation Congress had done to allow the online input. But the interesting thing is that they phrase it as online input. I did have a chance to get some information from Larry on that because I think they're still working things out. But basically what's going to happen is that somebody can come to the hearings that night and they're going to get a county code, which would then allow them to vote and have input towards the count in that county. But the other thing is that if somebody wanted to be voting online, they would do that. But those votes, as I understand it, would not count towards the votes in that county. They would count for the statewide votes on different issues. So it is a way for people to vote online. But, and of course, and in the county, there are local resolutions that come up, and there also are the elections for people. So it sounds to me like you'd have to be there or get this county code. I think they're still working it out, but I know they're very pleased to come forward with this and give it a try. Pat may have some other thoughts
Pat,
on it.
Pat, any thoughts?
I haven't really dug into that one yet, but I guess my initial concern is, of course, when you do online surveys, I think most of us know that they are no longer scientific, you know, because it's basically based on who has the desire to weigh in on various issues. So the thing, though, that Larry Bondi has talked about in the past as conservation chairman, the Congress chairman, is that it basically will be something they look at and take into consideration but aren't bound by it. And so they could still overrule, you know, a certain vote or a certain tally if they just determine that this is basically just a lot of people with one axe to grind on a particular issue and just really rallied their forces to call in and vote on those things. So, you know, to me, if it gets more people involved, I guess I'm all for it. But I still don't like the idea that, you know, if something matters to you, you have to get off your butt, drive someplace, and cast your ballot. And I'll always defend. I've tracked the Conservation Congress hearing totals, you know, for attendance going back into the early 70s, and I update my chart every year to keep track of it. And really, yeah, there's been some decline over the last decade, but it's not dramatic. It's still, in the big picture as far as public hearings go, I guess the Conservation Congress, I would say, should never be embarrassed about its tallies. I mean, it has a pretty good overall vote year to year. That's not, you know, to me, it's not bad. So I guess I'm willing, though, to sit back and wait and talk to people and listen to what they've studied. Because, you know, guys like Mark Schultz and Larry Bondi, I'm sure, put a lot of thought into this. So I hate to dismiss the idea until I hear more from them.
Makes sense. Let's take another call on probably onto another topic. Harold in Superior, your turn. Hi, Harold.
Yes, good afternoon. Or no, I suppose it's still morning. Yeah. I have just recently been wondering why we need to stock fish as much as we do and have slot limits and so on, as opposed to taking a lake and improving the spawning and habitat, you know, of course, for walleye, like my preferred fish. But I know they used to put in cribs. I don't know if they still do that. But isn't there like a particular, sand and gravel, rocky type thing that walleyes, for instance, need for spawning?
Dean, we'll start with you. Dean Broids.
Sure. We do some of that, Harold, but maybe not necessarily up in your area. I know they've done some of that on Winnebago, and some people lost their lives doing it. I think part of it is we may have changed the habitat of a lake so much where it might have been at one time a good walleye reproducer, now may not be quite so because of things that have happened over time. Usually, if we just let a lake be what it wants to be instead of trying to make it what we want it to be, you know, it'll do okay. We want to make a lot of lakes walleye lakes that really should not be walleye lakes, and so we stock them. And that's, you know, by and large, not, you know, maybe not the only way to have walleyes in there, but the most efficient way to have walleyes in there. That's probably why we're seeing walleye stocking in a lot of lakes that we do stock. But there are also lakes where we do spawning reef projects. The DNR does spawning reef projects, usually in conjunction with a local lake association.
Yeah, it makes sense. Pat, anything from you?
Yeah, I think Dean and I were maybe the only people in the state who really weren't all that excited about Governor Walker's walleye initiative, you know, and really cranking up the walleye stocking. And for me, I guess the reason is that I remember a fisheries biologist named Dick Harris from back in the Oshkosh area, and Dick's been gone now about 30 years. But Dick used to always make the comment that that stocking is kind of a political tool more than a biological tool, and he always likened it to he said in cities, city government, that they want to keep people calm down, they build them a swimming pool, it gives them something to do in the summer. And he said, in fishing, we back up the tanks and drop a bunch of walleyes in the Lake Winnebago just to make people feel good. Because I guess back in the 50s, even though the walleyes were doing okay on their own, the old conservation department would occasionally do this thing where they go to a hatchery, pick up a bunch of fry or fingerlings and release them where people could see, and they'd have the newspaper come down and take pictures of it, and everybody's happy. Well, and he's in the big picture, they really accomplished nothing besides public relations. So anyway, I always liked Dick's comparison between, you know, the build a swimming pool, keep people happy in the summer, and then if they're not catching enough fish, you have back up a tanker and dropping a bunch of walleyes, and everybody goes home and they're happy again. And really, though, it's dishonest in the big picture.
Interesting. Talking wildlife today, all kinds of wildlife issues and experiences with our three guests. Tim Isley with us. Tim, a full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. And Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Talking wildlife and the outdoors today with Tim Isley, Patrick Durkin, and Dean Bortz. Great to have them with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for joining us. All of our lines are filled, so let's go back to the phones. And Lori in Green Bay. Lori, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Usually if I see a turtle on the road, I'll take it off and put it in the direction that it's going in the other ditch or whatever. And I rescued my first one of this year about an hour ago, and it had these lumps on it. At first, I couldn't figure out what it was, and I guess they were bloodsuckers. Do those affect them at all? Like, you know, wood ticks on an animal, or I never thought about what the shells are made of.
Oh, this was on the shell?
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Anybody got a thought on that one?
Boy, not me.
No, I don't know. If they're on the shell, I can't imagine it would harm the turtle at all. If there was one or two on its legs or neck or appendages, probably not a problem. If it had 30, yeah, probably would be a problem. I really don't know a lot about that one.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right, Dean. I think if Lori finds one with a couple of bloodsuckers on them, that's not probably going to be an issue. Having had bloodsuckers on myself, they don't get a lot.
Well, how long did you leave them on, Larry?
They were off soon after I discovered them. Let's put it that way. Turtles, if they're even on the shell, I couldn't imagine being a problem. And if they're on their legs, they can probably knock them off if they need to, they want to. So I don't think it's an issue. But interesting. I hadn't heard of anybody finding bloodsuckers on turtles.
I guess the thing I'd just interject on the whole topic of turtles is this is the time of year you are seeing more of them out. You start to move around now and getting ready to do their egg laying and stuff. And the one thing that always bothers me and fascinates me at the same time is why people feel compelled to run them over. And instead of just steering around them because they aren't moving fast, you can so easily steer around them in a lot of these areas with a crossing. It's not necessarily a highway. It's sometimes it's back the back roads. So, but there is something about some people they see something in the road, like a turtle, and they intentionally go their way to kill it. I don't understand that.
Yeah,
I think Lori should be commended for stopping, as she said, and when you can safely do that, and there isn't the traffic that you can help a turtle get across safely to the other side, she ought to be commended.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Lori. Appreciate your call. Mike in Fond du Lac, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. This is Mike Arrowwood. I would like to give a pitch for a program that deals with fish and habitat and that sort of thing in Wisconsin. Because listening to your callers today, there's a lot of misinformation, but people that don't really know a lot about fish and fish habitat. And I think it would do well to have a one-hour program like on Winnebago. There's the proposal for a 3-bag limit. That's a 40% reduction in exploitation. Well, the problem that we have on Winnebago is not exploitation, in my opinion, but forage. There's two basic forage species here. One is gizzard shad and one are trout perch. And in the two times recently that we've had a spawning failure of those two species, exploitation goes through the roof. And there's really nothing we can do about those two species and whether they spawn or not, or have a successful spawn. So I think it would be good to have an extended or expanded dialogue about, fish habitat, what they need to survive, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, Jill Deneau, my producer, is probably listening. She may have heard that, but that would make a good show. And, just spend the whole 90 minutes or an hour talking fish. We'd done it in the past, but haven't done that for a long, long time. So I agree with you, Mike. We'll see what we can do about that. Maybe get somebody from DNR Fisheries along with maybe one of these characters here, Dean or Pat or Tim, and see what we can come up with. Thanks. Go ahead.
Mike's still on the phone. Could we ask him what he thinks about the 3-walleye bag limit, the reduction to 3?
Mike, what do you think?
Well, I've made my point in the past, both with Kendall and Adam Nichol, our biologist, that I don't think it's necessary at this time. They had a series of public meetings, and they based their opinion upon a formula that they use. Well, they agreed that the formula they use has been based upon not good information. So with the new tag study that's came out, we have a reward tag program on Winnebago where last year 212 fish were tagged with $100 reward tags. And of those 212, there were only 24 that were returned. That's only a 14% exploitation. So their number that they're giving at these hearings was they're talking 35 and 40%. Well, that's not being borne out by this $100 reward tag program. So I have a real concern about this effort.
Yeah. Dean?
I just wanted to point out that Mike is the chairman of Walleyes, or president of Walleyes for Tomorrow, and has a long-time history of working on the lake. So he's as well-informed as anybody in what's going on in Lake Winnebago.
Yeah. Mike, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We'll take more calls here. And Ann has a different topic from Green Bay. Ann, hello.
Hello. First of all, I'd like to say because people run over turtles and little critters on the road simply because they have no respect for life and they have no respect for nature, and it just drives me crazy. But I actually called to talk about CWD. I am not a big fan of deer farms. I'm actually opposed to them, and I really think that's where the CWD started with. But I'm just wondering where this whole fencing issue has gone, because I don't believe as taxpayers we should be responsible for paying for extra fencing for these deer farm fencing. So I'm just wondering if you know anything about that.
All right. Dean, you want to start?
Sure. What I don't know yet in the governor's proposal here is who's paying for the fencing. Maybe Pat has heard about something about that, but he hasn't, when I say he, the governor hasn't indicated in his outline of his plan on where that funding is going to come from, or if it's going to be funded by or paid for by the deer farm owners. So we might be a little early on that one.
Pat, anything?
Yeah. Well, I know Governor Walker said he was open to discussing the idea of providing grants or something for deer farmers to put up the, I think they're calling it enhanced fencing, which can mean a second 8-foot fence all around the property, or an interior electrical fence, and so there is that possibility. But then, yeah, I'm guessing it will be a hot topic among the people who appear at the public hearings that are coming up to discuss these issues that we'll be addressing CWD with. And yeah, I don't know what the perfect solution is, because you know people want the government to do something about these deer farms, but then at the same time don't want to pay for any of it. And you know, and if you say, well, then the next thing they should do is shut them down. Well, if you shut down a private business, typically there's compensation for that. So these are tough issues. It's not like we have not considered these issues in the past, and typically the politicians, elected representatives, have always walked away from actually buying out people and shutting them down in a widespread statewide manner. It would be expensive.
Yeah, it would.
There's going to be the public hearing that went to the Natural Resources Board approved this public hearing, but they came out with a scope statement that didn't say very much. We know that the governor has come out with basically wanting the department to do something regarding deer carcass transportation and deer farm fencing. So they have this scope statement, which really didn't say much, but the public hearing then is going to be June 11th at 5 o'clock at the Comfort Suites in Portage. So people who have some ideas on this or want to be able to talk about this and what deer farms should do, then I think they want to make some comments known at that hearing that's coming up on June 11th.
Yeah, makes sense. Thanks again for that call. Josh at UW-Whitewater, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call real quick. We're kind of jumping back to the subject on leeches on turtles.
Yeah.
I work with primarily with amphibians and reptiles, and I think it's to understand the interaction between leeches and turtles, it's first important to understand that there's incredibly limited information available on these types of dynamics in amphibians and reptiles compared to other, you know, Wisconsin wildlife. And so there's really not much known about that impact. In fact, the best information that I've ever been able to find. It just involves how, you know, prevalence of leech parasitism varies in intensity by species or, you know, by pond type. So the bottom-walking turtles like snapping turtles and musk turtles, you know, tend to have higher leech densities on them than the free-swimming or the more frequently free-swimming turtles. And you tend to find higher leech densities on turtles that are in turbid waters. But the impact that they actually have on the turtles is very understudied.
Very interesting. I'm really glad you called, Josh. That was something that I... There's another topic we've never talked about on the show before, and it's always fun to be able to do that. Boy, we've got Ryan in Wausau, Dave in Trout Lake. Oh, Dave, hang on there. He's got some information on Trout Lake muskies, or maybe a question. And Susan in Coon Valley, those folks are all waiting to join us. And they will all have the chance to do that as we visit with our three guests, Dean Bortz from Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer, editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. The time always flies by when they're with us, but there's still a line open for you, the number to call 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, and we'll be back with our guests right after the news. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network, taking a look at the world of wildlife today with our three guests, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. Every one of our lines is full, so I'm going to go right back to the phones. We got Elizabeth, Ryan, Dave, and Susan all on board here. Let's go to Ryan in Wausau, who is next in line. Ryan, thanks.
How you guys doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I just had a question. My wife and I spent some time over in Coulee Country last week, and we're catching some trout, really enjoying our time over there. And while we were there, I noticed the regulations had significantly changed on a lot of the streams. And I wondered, it seems like a huge paradigm shift that we're moving from places that were catch and release only to places that are you can now keep five fish of any length. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on why that paradigm shift is happening and what are the implications of that as well.
Okay. Tim Isley, I'm going to turn to you first.
Well, I think the regulations have changed because of the fish. I think they have enough trout over there. They've done so well on the management. You know, what the Department of Natural Resources has done in those western Coulee streams and over there in the Driftless region has been so fantastic. David Ventrano, who the retired fish manager, who was working with wild trout and some really neat and innovative things. So I think they have good trout populations. There are people who are concerned about some of the regulations, say that some people aren't able to keep enough fish. So, I mean, you have people on both sides, but the DNR right now has a trout committee that is looking at the trout regulations in the state. So I think you're going to see that within the next year, well, later this year probably, they're going to be coming out with some recommendations to take a whole new look at the trout regulations. But I think we've got a very good trout resource.
Yeah, that's probably exactly the correct answer. Ryan, thanks. Dave in Trout Lake, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. I'm responding to the comment you made earlier about the 85-pound muskie in Trout Lake. You know, it could perhaps be true given the size and the habitat and the forage. But the comment that I'd like to offer, 6 or 7 out of the last 10 years, I've had an opportunity to talk with the guys who are actually conducting the census on Trout Lake. And the last 2 years, they've shared with me some very discouraging numbers about the number of sexually mature reproducing muskies on the lake. It's terrible. And I assume that their information is correct. And I wondered if any of your guests have any information about the decline of the muskie population on Trout Lake.
Oh boy, that is sad, because that was always, that's always been a great muskie fishery, and some really big muskie in that water. Dean, do you have anything, or Pat?
Well, I can jump in here for a little bit. This is Dean. No, I really don't. I do get a chance to talk to the local fisheries biologist quite a bit. And, you know, Steve Gilbert, for many years, has been the Vilas County fish biologist. He's now the regional supervisor, and we have a new fish biologist. I think Hadley Baim has been up here for about a year and a half now. And I know they've been looking at Trout Lake, but I have not talked to those folks lately about what they've been finding. Dave probably has more information about that than I do. But his question as far as why that might be happening, well, I don't know. You know, it's, nah, I'm not going to go there.
Pat, any thoughts from you, Pat Durkin?
Nothing real specific to that, but I guess my thought, and this goes back to the previous caller too, is that one good thing about our system here is that we understand that science is always evolving, and our understanding of the different dynamics of fishing are always changing. And so the only way we can really respond intelligently is to have these creel surveys going on and putting people out there to collect this information day in, day out, putting crews out there to monitor the fish as best we can. And that's where I guess I'd also point out to people that none of this is free, that, you know, people have to pay for these services in this learning process we have. And so I'd encourage people, when they buy their fishing licenses and their hunting license, they understand that this is how we pay for this kind of information.
Yeah, wish we had more on this, Dave, but we'll, yeah, it's something else that's worth looking into. We'll see what
there's
else we can.
There's another story idea. You know,
yeah, there's.
That's how we get readers and listeners. They contact us and let us know about stuff they're wondering, and it often turns into a story.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Appreciate the call. And Susan in Coon Valley, it's your turn. Hi, Susan.
Good morning, or afternoon, I guess. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Your guests may be able to address this, they may not, but I've been trying to replace my lures with non-lead lures versus everything you see is made of lead. And my question is this, that if more and more fishing people would start asking for non-lead lures, maybe the companies would start producing more. And I say that because so much lead is found in ducks, it's been found in eagles, it's been found in anything that feeds within our waters. And I think our wildlife is precious enough that, you know, maybe people that fish would be willing to pay a little more for non-lead fishing equipment.
Yeah, some good points. Pat, you want to comment?
Yeah, I think I try to do the same thing. I over time I've gone more and more to fishing with crankbaits for walleyes, and I find even deer hunting now. I'm shooting copper bullets. I'm trying to find different ways to do this, and I guess it goes back to the simple idea that when it becomes something that we have to pay for, it might have to be something at some point here where there's a penalty. We almost have to pay almost like a tax to start using stuff like lead-based lures or lead-based bullets or whatever it might be. And when you start basically providing that disincentive to using that stuff, well, then people start thinking about it. They start, you know, start taking action in terms of, you know, demanding it. But, you know, as long as the product is always out there in a cheap form, and there's no real demand or no real action being taken to bring about change. Well, you know, we've been talking about the lead issue in fishing lures as long as I've been an outdoor writer, and that goes back into the early 80s, and it really hasn't changed a whole lot.
Yeah. Tim Isley?
Sure. I think it's great that she's trying to do that to heighten awareness. And an organization that has been trying to do the same thing as Project Loon Watch up in Ashland, because they actually put out some of the non-lead sinkers or jigs trying to get fishermen to use. But I agree. I think we should try as much as we can to go to the non-lead, and it's just like in hunting. I won't buy any more lead shotgun shells, and I also have got the non-lead rifle bullets. I think we should go that way. I mean, if as a sportsman, if I'm taking the life of something which is an accident, a loon or something like that, by eating something, a lead sinker on the bottom, I should take responsibility for that, and I should try not to do it.
It'd be hard to imagine how many tons of lead in all the lakes in Wisconsin and Minnesota. It'd be, I couldn't even guess.
But I think some of it does sink down and will get buried eventually in the bottom, so that it wouldn't be accessible to the birds.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take Elizabeth in Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, good afternoon. I was listening to your conversation about the turtles, and one of my Facebook friends just posted a couple days ago, they redid their lawn and put in new landscape and new seed, and of course, all of a sudden, they had, at one time, she saw 6 snapping turtles up by the house laying eggs. Their dog is not wanting to go outside. And she's envisioning hundreds of baby turtles around their yard. So any suggestions I can give her?
Oh, my goodness. Well, let's see. Snapping turtle specialist Dean Bortz, what have you got for us?
I think she just has to be patient and wait probably till about mid-August, late August, for the eggs to hatch and for the little ones to crawl back to the water, and then she can go ahead and put her lawn back in. Maybe cover them with some sort of screen or wiring screen to keep the raccoons out of there so that they don't raid the nests.
She might contact the Department of Natural Resources, people like Bob Hay, who now has retired, but who are really good herpetologists, and they may have some people there that might be able to give her some suggestions, too.
Yeah. Yep. There you go, Elizabeth. Thanks for calling. Tom in Washington Island.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about turtles as well.
Okay.
I work at a nature center up here, and last summer we got a couple of painted turtles that one of them had, must have been 40 leeches on it. And the other one had leeches as well. These were separate occasions. And they kind of hide way up underneath the legs. They were feeding. We were able to treat it with a saline solution. So if anybody does find turtles out there that they want to get the leeches off, that was how we did it.
Saline solution. There we go. A little water and salt, huh? Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. 40. Oh, my goodness. And on a painted turtle, they don't, they're not bottom walkers at all, as far as I know. Let's go to Dana in Green Bay. Hi, Dana.
Hello there. I've got a question regarding hawks today. I've got in our backyard, in one of the tall trees, a hawk nest. And consequently, I found carcasses of small birds. And I've also noticed that this has been the quietest bird season for years. It's a ghost town. There's no birds out there at all. And I'm wondering, how do I go about, is there any way to encourage the hawks to move along?
Do you have bird feeders?
I do, yeah.
One thing I'm pretty sure is if you want the hawk to leave, you pretty much have to stop feeding the birds, probably, because you are providing his. You've got a feeder for the hawk, is what you've got. But I'm not the expert here. What about Tim? What do you think?
I assume it could very well be a Cooper's hawk or something, and I think the only thing to do is sit back and enjoy the hawk, because it's going to be finding its lunch and dinner there. And they're protected birds, obviously. You can't disturb the nest and do anything to the birds. So I think you have to just sit back and enjoy the hawk, unfortunately.
Well, they're kind of fun to, yeah, I mean, they're fun to watch.
Fantastic birds.
Yeah, they're fun to watch. So you're just going to have to get your camera out and watch and see what happens, Dana.
Yeah, my experience, Larry, is that with Cooper's hawks, it kind of ebbs and flows. You know, if you let things play out, typically the birds might stay away for a while, and then when the Cooper's hawk or whatever kind of hawk it is that's around there moves off, then they return, and then eventually the hawk realizes that there's food available again, and sweeps back through. And so I always see this same kind of ebb and flow all the time around our place. We've had a number of Cooper's hawks over the years, and sometimes you find the leftovers out in the yard where they've struck a robin or a mourning dove, but eventually the birds come back, and then just keeps up and down all the time.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Dana. Peter in Madison, your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Larry. Great show.
Thank you.
I just got a question. So quite a few people have been calling about, lead weights when they're fishing and all of the lures that are traditionally lead-based. So I'm an avid fly fisherman, so conservation's kind of high on my list. So what I've noticed over the years is that beads and such for tying flies has transitioned slowly away from a lot of lead towards tungsten. And I've even seen some high-end fishing lures for walleyes and catfish make that same transition. So I'm just wondering if maybe, slowly but surely things are kind of phasing out, and if that's seen as some sort of a benefit at this point.
Yeah, a good thought. Dean Bortz, any comment?
We're seeing more folks using tungsten, especially in the winter, for ice fishing, instead of using lead jigs or using tungsten. We have more writers writing about the use of tungsten over lead. I think it's slowly happening on its own as fishermen, realize what lead can do and learn how to use tungsten in a way that they might have used lead in the past.
Yeah.
I don't know that tungsten is being used. Well, most actual lures, so like hard lures, like Pat mentioned, crankbaits, spinners, they're usually not made out of lead. So we're probably basically talking jigs and sinkers. But more of the jigs are now more jigs are being offered in tungsten, so that there's a greater variety out there for fishermen to choose from.
Yep. Karen in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Thanks for having this show. We heard you talking about fishing, and I wanted to call and mention that the Tainer Creek Farmer-Led Watershed Council of Vernon and Crawford County is presenting a Stream and Farms Field Day this Saturday, June 2nd, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., and it's at the Bruce and Sue Risto Farm right on Tainer Creek on County Road B in Soldiers Grove, and there's going to be a rainfall simulator demonstration, and it's a free fishing weekend, so there'll be free fishing for children and families with trout expert Jay Thurston. They're going to do some fish shocking so that kids can learn what lives in the stream and how to keep trout happy and healthy, and we're providing free lunch for all who attend. So just wanted to make sure that people knew about that. Again, it's a free fishing weekend, so no license is required. And some sponsors are going to be giving away some fishing gear for kids. We'll just encourage people to come out and have a good time on our Streams and Farms Field Day.
And Karen, again, just so people are in the know, where is it again?
It's at the Bruce and Sue Risto Farm, which is right on Tainer Creek, which is a Class A trout stream. It's at 50324. County Road B, Soldiers Grove, Wisconsin. And if they want more information, they can call 608-637-5480.
637-5480?
Yes, that's correct.
Karen, thanks so much for calling. And hopefully, Tim, there's several of those kinds of events.
Yeah, that's a great one. I saw that listed in my issue of the Crawford County Independent this last week, and Jay Thurston is really knowledgeable, good trout guy, and I think people will really enjoy that.
We have Tom in Muscadet up. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon. That unusual story last night, I was going out to walk my dog about 8:30, and as I went out the door,
there were four small grouse walking in file right outside my door. They scooted back into some bushes, but I got a picture of them. I would send it in, only I don't know how to do that. I never have. And it's not the first time I've had a grouse in my yard. About 7 years ago, I had an adult that stayed around for a day or so. And then last fall, I had a turkey loose in the tree in the backyard, and I'm not on the outskirts of town. I'm just a couple blocks from the high school.
Interesting. Well, grouse, that brings up, I know, Tim, you wanted to comment on grouse.
Well, there's been a lot of interest in rough grouse lately because of the West Nile virus that they've found in some other states, the West Nile virus in grouse, and they are concerned about it. And in fact, at the Natural Resources Board meeting last week then, they were talking about it, and they're supposed to get a report to the Natural Resources Board, the DNR is, at the June meeting, just the status of grouse in Wisconsin. They wanted to get some of the drumming counts to find out whether they're up or down in Wisconsin here, and then also so that the board could take a look at it and see if there's a need for an emergency rule or something else to reduce, shorten the season a little bit if West Nile virus is in fact in grouse and if that's a reason for the downturn in grouse population.
Interesting. I wanted to, boy, we got only about a minute or so to go here, but the Congress recently defeated the Farm Bill. Why? And this has some importance for wildlife in the state, does it not, Tim?
Well, the Farm Bill is one of the largest conservation programs, really, in the nation, because our Farm Bill has so much to do with agriculture and, of course, farm commodities and everything else. But one of the important things, there's a couple of the parts of that. One is CRP, the Conservation Reserve Program, which basically sets aside some of the erodible land. But that land then can be put into wildlife habitat. And EQIP, that can provide private landowners with some grants. We at one time had 30 million acres in the United States in CRP, and now we're down to, it's capped at 24 million acres. So the Farm Bill is adopted by Congress about every 4 to 5 years. And so a week ago Friday, they defeated the House bill. So it's something that people should keep their eyes on and contact, hopefully, their Congress people to say, hey, we need CRP, and hopefully it can be expanded. But it's really an important program. People ought to keep their eye on that one.
Good one to keep their eye on, and I'm keeping my eye on the clock here, and we're running a bit out of time. Boy, it's always fun, and I don't know when 90 minutes goes any quicker. Dean Bortz, thank you much.
I just will mention that I sent Jill an email with a list of the 6 counties that have 28-inch minimum size limits for muskies.
Oh, good.
You can pop that up on your website. And the only other thing I'd mention is that the deadline's coming up to apply for our elk permits for our first elk season this fall.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much for being with us today. Pat Durkin, thank you as well.
Thank you, Larry.
It's always fun. And Tim Isley, always great.
Thank you, Larry. Enjoyed it.
Dean Bortz is editor of the Wisconsin Outdoor News. Patrick Durkin is a freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. What an interesting 90 minutes. I learned a lot. I hope you did as well. And we'll have them back in a few months, and we will go over this again. There'll probably be a whole new set of issues that we can talk about. We didn't get to everything by any means at all. Tomorrow at 11, we turn our attention to women's infertility issues at 11, then 11:45, talk depression and anxiety that can sometimes accompany pregnancy. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.